Since 1979, TireRack.com has been helping people find the right tires for how, what, and where they drive. They sell only the best, like the full line of Firestone tires. Test results, ratings, and reviews are there to assist. Or try the Tire Decision Guide to get a personalized tire recommendation. Tires ship fast and free to you or to one of over 10,000 recommended installers. In many areas, they offer mobile tire installation. Shop Firestone Tires at TireRack.com.
When it comes to fitness, what's real? How about when it really, truly fits your life? That's how Anytime Fitness sees it. Because our coaches see you. It's how they build personal plans that work wherever you are and focus on everything that matters, from fitness to nutrition to recovery, all so you can push yourself further than ever or just through the next rep. It's total 360 support for a real difference. That's Anytime Fitness. That's real AF. Visit AnytimeFitness.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Fallujah exploded in rage this week. The response from the rest of Iraq was not one of universal condemnation. There is a long, tough road still ahead for democracy and the United States in Iraq. And if the project is to succeed beyond Baghdad, our guest tonight says, the U.S. has to win an even bigger battle. It has to triumph over a growing vein of contempt in the world for the West itself. Tonight on Point, Ian Baruma on exporting democracy and rage at the West. But first, strong numbers on the job front today. The Labor Department reported this morning that the U.S. economy added 308,000 jobs in March, well ahead of expectations. This was welcome news for the Bush administration. Greg Gipp covers the economy for the Wall Street Journal. I asked him where the surge in job growth came from.
Tom, it's amazing. I think it was just a month ago I was on your show and we were talking about what a horrible situation it was when we had just created 21,000 lousy jobs in the month of February.
Nobody liked that number.
That was a pretty depressing figure. And here we are, just a month later, we've got a 308,000 jobs in the month of March, the best performance in 4 years. Very broad-based improvement. In fact, one of the most striking facts about the monthly employment performance is that fully 60% of the more than 200 categories that the Labor Department tracks increased their payrolls in that month. That is a very good figure, one of the best in years. Sadly, one of them was not manufacturing. In fact, manufacturing payrolls were unchanged for the month. But that's still positive because they had gone over 40 straight months of declining job totals in that sector.
So just treading water is an accomplishment there. What are some of the sectors that did do very well this last month?
Construction did very well, Tom. They added about 71,000 jobs. And partly that was payback from February when employment declined, partly because it was a very bad month vis-a-vis the weather.
Mm-hmm.
And retailing added a lot of jobs. We had 13,000 jobs in groceries, which was partly a result of the grocery strike ending in California. But apart from that, it was very broad-based. It was in business services, in government, in other services, in leisure and hospitality. Just the breadth of it, Tom, is perhaps the most encouraging part of the employment report.
So good jobs news across a broad front. Does this mean, Greg, that the Bush economic plan is working? The tax cuts are working?
Tom, I think it's way too soon to say that. For one thing, this is just 1 month. We were very, of course, depressed a month ago when we had that lousy report for February.
Mm-hmm.
Let's keep in mind just how quickly the tone can change. I don't think things were as bad as they looked in February, and they're probably not as good as they look in March. The truth is probably somewhere in between. And that means the jury is still out on whether the recovery is in the jobs market is really here for good. And by the same token, the jury is still out on whether the president's policies have really turned things around here.
The president clearly is going to be feeling better about this. He was talking it up today, saying the economy is strong and it's getting stronger. Greg Mankiw, his economic advisor, saying it's time to make those tax cuts permanent. Do economists agree with these views, Greg?
The economists would say, in general, Tom, that it's apples and oranges. The tax cuts and making them permanent is really a separate issue entirely from what's going on in the job market. A lot of people out there on Wall Street will say, yeah, make the tax cuts permanent, but you push them real hard, and they will admit that it probably would make no difference at all to the job situation today. I mean, really, if you go and ask a businessman, you know, why are you hiring or why are you not hiring, they don't say it's because of taxes are too high or taxes are too low, or they don't really bring up taxes at all. They're looking at their order books. They're looking at their sales. They're looking at how good conditions are in the markets where they compete. They're looking at things like how strong is competition from overseas or from the next town over. And they're also looking at how well they can meet their sales with the workforce that they already have. And one of the striking features of the recovery of the last year or two is how high productivity has been. It's just been phenomenal how much extra product we've been able to get out of the workers that we already have. And while that is very good in the long run, because higher productivity is what higher wages come from, in the short run, it's been very depressing for the jobs market. And I think that will be a far more important factor in the next year or two on how the employment situation looks than anything to do with taxes.
Now, even with these good job creation numbers, the unemployment rate, crept up in the last month. How do you explain that, Greg?
Yeah, counterintuitively, perhaps. It's actually a good sign, Tom. And the reason why it went up...
Just to 5.7 from 5.6, I should say.
That's correct, yes. And the reason it went up is that the number of people out there looking for work went up. And in fact, it went up by 179,000. And the fact that people have enough confidence that they think there's work out there to be found is encouraging, and that's why the unemployment rate went up. And for the same reason, the fact that it, in prior months, had actually gone down from, I think, around 6.3% was not very encouraging, because that was mostly because people were dropping out of the labor force on the view that there was no work out there to be found.
Greg, what are the indicators looking ahead at the job market? Are they promising or not? What do you see?
Yes, Tom, they're actually quite encouraging. In fact, one of the big mysteries prior to today was why, given all the other supportive information, had payroll employment been so weak? If you look, for example, at the number of people filing claims for unemployment insurance, that number has dropped to about 340,000, which is the lowest in 4 years, and a level of claims activity that has traditionally been consistent with a very healthy jobs market. There are a number of surveys out there by manufacturing purchasing managers, a survey by Manpower Incorporated, which is a temporary help supply company, and they find a very large proportion of firms out there planning to hire people in the next few months.
So how many months of strong job growth do economists want to see before they say this is all working again, that economic growth and employment growth are in sync again, maybe for Alan Greenspan to say time to tick up those interest rates?
Well, I think for the average economist out there, they would like to see 3 to 6 months of increases in this range. Maybe not 300,000, but certainly averaging 200,000. For the Federal Reserve, I think the bar is perhaps a little bit higher. Remember, they have a couple of priorities here. They want to make sure this expansion is well and truly entrenched before they raise interest rates. The last thing they want to do is do it prematurely, cause the markets to collapse, and have the economy go right back into a funk. And end up in a situation like Japan had, where their central bank raised interest rates prematurely. And the other thing you're looking at is inflation. It's still very low. If you strip out energy and food prices, which are quite volatile, it's barely above 1%. That's actually a little bit too low for some Fed officials, who are a little bit worried that if it got any lower, they could be looking at deflation as opposed to inflation. And when you look at the jobs report, one of the interesting facts is that hourly earnings are rising very, very slowly. They're going up by less than 2% a year, which is one of the lowest rates of increase we've had in over a decade.
Wow.
And so from the Federal Reserve's point of view, they look at that and they say, well, it's great to have the job creation numbers out there, but we don't see the evidence that it's feeding through into costs. So I don't think the Fed will be shifted off its policy of being patient about raising interest rates.
So still a wait and see at the Fed, but for today, the fastest bump in job creation rate since April of 2000, and that is good news. Greg, thanks very much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Greg Ipp covers the economy for the Wall Street Journal. He spoke with us from Washington. A volatile mix of anger and shame in Fallujah tonight as the charred and mutilated bodies of four Americans were finally wrapped in white shrouds. This is a bad advertisement for everything we stand for, said one Iraqi. We may hate Americans, we may hate with all our hearts, but all men are creatures of God. Many issues intersect in Fallujah. Sunnis, fearful of demotion, Saddam loyalists, outraged at losing power. But beneath it all may lie a dark view of America and the West itself. Our guest tonight, Ian Baruma, says the problem isn't just with occupation or the challenge of exporting democracy. America and the West, he says, have an image problem. In too many corners, the West isn't seen as a champion of freedom and hope, but as soulless, decadent, faithless, unfeeling. It's the stereotype Baruma calls Occidentalism, and it's being exploited, he says, by enemies of the West. 25 years ago, in his landmark book, Orientalism, Edward Said blew apart long-held caricatures of the East. Now Ian Baruma says the West needs to do the same. This hour on Point, Ian Baruma and the West in the eyes of its enemies. What did you see deep in the rage in Fallujah? How is the United States viewed today by its enemies, by its friends? What is it about America, about the West, that Islamic extremists are fighting? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Ian Baruma, professor of democracy, human rights, and journalism at Bard College. He's co-author, along with Avishai Margalit, of the new book, Occidentalism, The West in the Eyes of Its Enemies. Good evening and welcome, Ian Baruma.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. You're laying out a compelling thesis here, and we're looking forward to digging into it tonight. Ian Baruma, you say that what we have here, at least for the moment, is not really a war of one civilization with another, but a tale of what you call cross-contamination, the spread of bad ideas. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, in the first place, I think what we see in Fallujah is not necessarily what we, my co-author and I, meant by Occidentalism, although it may be an element in it.
We grant you that. Many issues on the surface here, but perhaps behind it, we'll look at that. But granted, mm-hmm. you're looking at a broader stage.
Yes. Well, our thesis is this, is that what the Islamist extremists are saying, which may seem on the surface something peculiar or unique to the Islamic world, in fact has many elements that are rooted in the West itself, and that when you look at the kind of juxtaposition that the religious revolutionaries of Al-Qaeda and so on make between a sort of an organic Islamic world, pure Islamic world, which is of course a fantasy, with warm human feelings and a collective spirit and deep spirituality and so on, is juxtaposed against this sort of ruthless machine-like civilization of the West, which is dedicated to money and comfort and materialism and soulless individualism. And this is precisely the kind of thing that Nazi and fascist thinkers said in the 1920s and 1930s, particularly in Germany, but not only in Germany. And that has its roots in the counter-enlightenment, when people started extolling native blood and soil against the universal ideals of the French and the French Revolution. So you see these the same set of ideas coming back in completely different historical and cultural periods and circumstances.
But now we see them foremost among the Islamic extremists. You describe this Occidentalism as a kind of thoroughgoing caricature, a deep and kind of brutal stereotyping. You say it's the evil twin of what Edward Said called Orientalism. Give us these two twins. How do they stand side by side?
Well, if Edward Said had one insight in the midst of some white noise, it was that there was a set of ideas about the Orient, which was dehumanizing, which depicted Orientals as less than morally adult and almost less than human, children, really, dedicated to sensual pursuits and cruelty and so on, which there is an element, a lot of truth in that. Not, of course, not all Western views of the non-West were like this, but certainly played a big role. Our thesis is that there is a kind of flip side to this, which is almost the opposite, which is an idea of Western civilization as without soul, that only dedicated to filthy lucre and materialist pursuits and so on. And it's the same, so it's the kind of thing that's said about America today by people who loathe America, not people who are simply critical of American policies, mm-hmm. but people who loathe the very idea of America. It used to be said about England by nationalists in Germany and France in the 19th century. It was said about France. It's, of course, also often said about anti-Semites about Jews, who often stand for these hateful caricatures. If you think of the universalism that plays into this, the Jews, in the eyes of anti-Semites, were both responsible for capitalism and for Bolshevism, and needless to say, also for all the other wicked things like materialism and addiction to money and so on and so forth.
So in practical terms, how do you see U.S. foreign policy today or global ambitions running into what you describe here as deep prejudice?
Well, I think that one has to really separate tactics and strategy from what we're talking about here. I mean, there definitely is a real problem with religious revolutionary extremists who want to destroy symbolically, if not totally, everything that they think the West stands for. They loathe the whole idea of the West as impure and inherently barbaric. And the West is not necessarily just geographic. This also goes for the secular governments in the Middle East, which they want to destroy. They are revolutionaries.
You may say that's not tactical, but if you're a U.S. soldier in Iraq right now, and some of this is floating around in the back of the minds of the people you're trying to work with, doesn't that put a kind of Teflon resistance over the efforts to engage?
Yes, it does, but I'm not sure that this is the main factor in the war in Iraq. It's certainly the main factor in groups such as the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and so on. I think the rage in Iraq may have elements of this because the religious revolutionaries certainly don't want the Americans and their Iraqi friends to succeed in establishing open liberal institutions. It's the last thing they would want.
Ian Bruma, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We'll be right back. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about exporting democracy and how the recipients see America, maybe some underlying views running through a lot of what America is dealing with today. My guest is Ian Bruma. He's co-author of the new book, Occidentalism, The West in the Eyes of Its Enemies. You can join the conversation tonight. What is the America, the West, that Islamic extremists are fighting? Is it a caricature? Is it the true core of the culture? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ian Bruma, it might be helpful to unbuckle this for a moment from all contemporary issues, even from Islamic extremism. You have this interesting Dutch-English background, spent a lot of time in Japan, and you open your book with an anecdote from 1942 Japan. Could you share that with us?
Yes, in 1942, in Kyoto, there was a conference of Japanese writers and intellectuals and thinkers who wanted to discuss a topic that they termed as overcoming the modern. And of course, by the modern, they meant the West. And the problem is that they didn't really it was difficult for them to arrive at a consensus of what they really meant by the West. Some of them meant what, in the phrase that was popular in the time in Germany as well as other places in Japan, Americanism, meaning Hollywood and Wall Street and the sort of shallow materialist values of capitalism and so on. As others talked about this European thing, meaning that European civilization was a kind of cancer in Japan, destroying the native spirit.
The machine civilization.
The machine civilization, which, of course, were ideas that were not specifically Asian or Japanese. These ideas were very common in Germany, in right-wing circles, too. And it's a form of anti-liberalism, anti-individualism, and it really goes back to the counter-enlightenment. And when it gets dangerous is when these become sort of purist visions, whose supporters really want to destroy everything that seems to be impure. In other words, in the case of the Nazis, they wanted a pure racial society, and so the impure elements in their eyes, specifically the Jews, had to be destroyed.
But let me ask you about that. Adolf Hitler used this kind of language.
Yeah,
you describe him talking about, quoting him, "American civilization is of a purely mechanized nature." I mean, this seems ironic. I mean, the image we have of the Nazi armies is of, you know, all kinds of mechanization on tank treads spreading over continents.
Yes, I mean, they were, just as Al-Qaeda today, are quite happy to use mobile phones and all the technology at their disposal. The Nazis were, of course, ambivalent about this. On one hand, they were very proud of their new freeways and the Volkswagen and all their technological achievements.
As were the Japanese of theirs, the great battleships and factories.
And that's right, and it's almost perhaps as a sort of form of overcompensation for this, that it's seen as a kind of that they have to come up with these purest ideals of pure race or pure religion or pure anything else. And when that becomes murderous, then we have a problem.
So is it ultimately a kind of racism that you're describing?
It can be racism. It can also be, in the case of religious extremists, of course, it's religious. The Islam, even the Islamic extremists, would accept people from all over the world, including Americans, as we know, in their midst, if they are prepared to submit to the ideals of Islamist extremists. So in their case, it's not ethnically based. In the case of the Nazis and to some extent the Japanese in the 1930s, it was.
So paint a picture then of exactly how widespread you see this today. What's the profile of this geographically or in terms of populations? Where does Occidentalism, this prejudice, this stereotyping caricature as you describe it, have its home now?
Well, its home is, of course, all over the world. That's what makes it so disturbing. And unlike in the case of the Nazis, who'd taken over one of the world's most modern and powerful states, the religious extremists have not managed to take over a state yet, and probably won't succeed in doing so. That is, of course, their aim. But what they can do, because of modern technology and the nature of information and so on, is even as a relatively marginal phenomenon in many countries, cause enormous amounts of damage and human suffering, and indeed can transform the nature of our own societies, which we can see not only in Europe, but especially in the United States today.
Well, here's where we get to where this perspective has to impinge on current events. If you say it can have this enormous destructive power and capacity, how is that evidenced?
Well, 9/11 was a pretty good instance, and the Bali bombing was another, and probably many similar plots have been foiled, thank goodness, but we can expect more of this. And what it's doing is it's turning our societies into more and more into fortresses under siege, but under siege not by powerful armies or powerful states, but by revolutionaries who are, even in their own societies, relatively marginal. Now, the problem, I think, with going to war with states, as we've done in Iraq, is that it can turn a lot of the people, and maybe that has a bearing on what's going on in Fallujah, who are relatively indifferent to the West as such, can turn them into haters of the West because we're seen as being sort of bullies going in there with armies to impose our own values.
And at some level, this Occidentalism, this what do you call it, cluster of prejudices, is then waiting to feed into that.
Yes. And I think it gains recruits, the war on terror is real enough. But I think there is a confusion that a lot of people still think in terms of a war against states, and I think this is a different animal.
Now, you're not saying that we've got perfect American policies globally, and it's all about prejudice. You said at the outset, and you write in the book, there are policies that might be criticized. You say, you know, support of anti-communist dictatorships at one time. Some people, the support of Israel, of multinational corporations, IMF, globalization. There's a lot of grist for people to chew on that doesn't fall into this category of Occidentalist prejudice, as you describe it.
Yes, I think it's perfectly possible and indeed legitimate to criticize aspects of American society or Western societies, capitalism, foreign policy, and so on, without wishing to destroy the world that one thinks it represents. And commit mass murder. That's when it becomes a real problem. I think criticism is not only legitimate, it's necessary.
It's not just, of course, you say this goes back to many Western thinkers, and then you describe how it came through Japan just weeks after Pearl Harbor. After the war, you describe the very influential Egyptian writer and thinker Sayyid Qutb coming to the United States. I think it was 1948. He went back and just let this view flow from his pen of just how depraved he found America.
Yes, and it's a relatively common phenomenon. I mean, I've noticed this about Japanese nationalists, or rather extreme nationalists, too, that they were often people who studied English literature or German literature, went to the West, were disappointed, felt not perhaps sufficiently recognized, had experiences of discrimination, go back home and really flip to the other extreme and become extreme nationalists, extolling the native soul and so on, and are in a rage against the West precisely because they've been confronted with it in their eyes in an unpleasant manner.
So it leaves me wondering, though, you describe the adjectives and the problems that this Occidentalist view would put against the United States. If you go into any theater in the United States and look at, you know, plays written over the last 50 years or more, you'll see a lot of this criticized by Americans, too. America's rootless, superficial, trivial, materialistic, fashion addicted, and so on. It's not as though Americans aren't self-critical on a number of these points. And for Egyptian thinkers, first of the United States, you say he was freaked out seeing American women dance to "Baby, It's Cold Outside." But I remember years ago, coming in from the provinces, my first trip to New York and Times Square, stepping into one of these seedy places, and being overwhelmed by the kind of depravity that is on display sometimes. So what's the distinction between self-criticism, between, you know, Americans know everything's not perfect, and this crossing of a line into something more, hateful, dangerously rage-filled?
Well, there is, of course, a huge difference between criticism and even distaste and the desire to destroy it and bomb it. I mean, those are two very different things. People who are critical of America, including Americans, would like to improve the things that they don't like about America or even get rid of those things. But they don't want to destroy America as such or what they think America represents. The extremists that we talk about want to destroy not just America. I mean, let's be clear about this. This is not the same as anti-Americanism. Mm-hmm. And the West we talk about is not necessarily just the geographical West. The Aum Shinrikyo in Japan, that extreme sort of quasi-Buddhist sect which put sarin gas in the Tokyo subways, they were in many ways on the same wavelength as the Al-Qaeda. They thought modern Japan had become soulless, materialistic, without meaning, without spirit, and wanted to sort of use gas to revolutionized Japan in what they saw as a spiritual way. And many of them were engineers and people who were involved in technology in one way or another.
We're talking tonight with Ian Buruma. He's co-author of the new book, Occidentalism, The West in the Eyes of Its Enemies. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Orlando is calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Orlando. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I just think this whole notion that Americans are soulless and heartless is ridiculous, because if we were, we would have taken Fallujah off the map for what they did to those American people the other day.
The firepower's there to do it, but it wasn't done.
Well, the Islamic extremists know what firepower we have, and for them not to see the restraint that we've had thus far after all these attacks on Americans, then I think they're kind of missing the point.
It is.
How can they call us heartless and braveless when we ain't showing our military might, as far as I'm concerned?
I hear exactly what you mean, Orlando. This is a particularly tough week to hear this kind of criticism. Ian Buruma, you know, a lot of Americans will be looking out at Iraq this week and say, oh my gosh, you've got these kids over there trying to build schools and bring democracy. And here we're looking at Americans strung up, hanging, dismembered from a bridge. Who's heartless? Who's soulless here?
Well, no, I would agree entirely with the caller. I mean, it's not me who's calling the West or America heartless or machine-like.
Understood.
Trying to describe what the enemies think and say.
But Orlando's saying, why doesn't this communicate? You know, Fallujah wasn't carpet-bombed.
Well, it doesn't communicate because, again, I don't want to talk about Fallujah specifically, but it doesn't communicate because it doesn't impress. If you're a revolutionary with a sort of purist vision, whether it's religious or racial or anything else, it doesn't change those people's minds to be a nice guy or build a school or sit around a seminar room and discussing the virtues of democracy. These people want a kind of revolution. And just as anti-Semites in the 1930s wouldn't have been impressed by the fact that many Jewish people may have been perfectly nice or had good intentions or anything like that, they wanted to destroy them. And these kind of extremists want to destroy as much as they can what they see as representative of the West.
On the other hand, you can't help but think the kind of deep unease that any country feels when there's an occupying army there, that any country feels when the big footprint of modernity starts to come in on old traditions, on old religion. Orlando, thanks for your call. Lloyd is calling from Alston, Massachusetts. Hi, Lloyd. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I think this discussion is too simplistic. I think what is going on is to the rest of the world when they see these multinational corporations come in is not so much a reaction of anti-West, but they see the damage that happens to their sovereignty, to their resources, to the forest, to the environment, to the way of life that was a great deal more less stressful before colonialism, before the West came, before the multinational corporations came, and I think that's more of a source of the anti U.S. anti Western feeling than these terrorists, because if you really look at the terrorist statistics, violence in the world is actually way down from 100 years ago.
So you're saying this isn't just about poetry, and this isn't poetry in a romantic notion.
What's that?
You're saying, Lloyd, this isn't just about poetry and some romantic notion of a clash here. That these are people seeing material consequences for their countries that they don't like.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when the IMF and World Bank go in and tell Kenya to start charging school fees for children to go to school, which causes a massive influx of child labor into the corporate coffee farms,
yeah.
You get resentment. And so, this is more of a real resentment than I think than these terrorists. I think the terrorists are there, but they're not there like they were 100 years ago. There was a great deal more terrorism 100 years ago than there is now.
Ian Bruma, Lloyd is saying this isn't prejudice. This is practical assessment and pushback.
Well, I agree that there's a lot of resentment about heavy-handed policies and multinational corporations and so on and so forth. The thing we didn't have 100 years ago was the phenomenon of suicide bombers or people who would launch suicidal attacks on what were essentially symbolic targets, even though they kill a lot of people as they do so. If multinational corporations and the destruction of forests and capitalism and so on were the real source of suicide bombers and extremism, you would see it in places like Thailand or Taiwan or South Korea much more than in the Middle East, which has actually been left behind in many ways by modern capitalism. So I think those resentments are indeed real enough, but they don't really explain the phenomenon that we were writing about.
I want to get one more call before the break. Abusam is calling from Hartford, Wisconsin. Hi, Abusam, you're on the air.
Hello there. I am a Muslim, and I have lived in the West. I can give you an honest view on how I see the roots of the conflict.
Please do.
Listen, Islam means submission to God, and
yes,
it has an ideology that encompasses not only the worship aspect, but also the economic, the political, everything in life that is required for a society to be built. Democracy is the same. Democracy talks about life and God. It says it has no role. It's secularism. It has economy, which is the freedom of enterprise. It has a social, which is the freedom of personal opinion expression. So what is being asked from a Muslim is to rid of his religion in exchange of another religion. And if you do not do that, we are going to bombard you and kill you. That's what a Muslim sees. Please do understand, as a Muslim is talking to you honestly.
Yes.
You're telling us to rid of Islam, and Muslims now are working to reestablish the Khilafah. Why can't we unite? Khilafah is a good thing.
Habusham, we only have a few seconds before the break, but we've got your point. I thank you for making it. Ian Bruma, our listener says, look, this is a clash of religions.
Well, I think perhaps we could go into that a little bit more after the break, but I don't think that it's fair to say that what the United States or the West or Britain are demanding is that Muslims give up their religion. I don't think that's true at all. I would agree with the caller that Islam is not incompatible with democracy. It's perfectly possible. Indeed, probably the establishment of democracy in Islamic countries has to go through the mosque. It has to be done in cooperation with moderate Muslims.
But I'm not sure that's what we're hearing there, but we'll come back and look at that. Ian Bruma, please stand by. The new book is Occidentalism, The West in the Eyes of Its Enemies. What is the America, the West, that Islamic extremists are fighting? How can America overcome this caricature, a soulless, decadent, money-grubbing, rootless, faithless, unfeeling? And are brutal stereotypes destined to fuel a clash of civilizations? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about exporting democracy and how the intended recipients may see America. My guest is Ian Baruma. He's co-author of the new book, Occidentalism, The West in the Eyes of Its Enemies. You can join the conversation. What is the America, the West, that Islamic extremists are fighting? How can America overcome this caricature as soulless, decadent, money-grubbing, rootless, faithless, unfeeling? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ian Baruma, I want to just pick up our caller Abu Hassam's message for just another minute. I think you and I heard this a bit differently. I heard him saying, I'm a good Muslim. I want to submit to my God, not yours. Don't call me prejudiced for that.
Yeah, no, I think that's perfectly valid. I don't think that what we identify as Occidentalism is not Islam. Islam is perfectly valid, and people should be able to believe whatever they wish. And I think it's not incompatible with free institutions and a free market economy and so on. I mean, take a country like Malaysia, which is politically by no means perfect, but it doesn't produce suicide bombers, and it's a relatively orderly and a very prosperous society. They enjoy all the fruits of modern life, and yet there are also many devout Muslims there, and this is perfectly possible. And I don't think anybody is demanding that people give up their religion at all, but I think it is often perceived as such, and this comes perhaps from a sense of humiliation on the one hand of many Muslims who live under very authoritarian regimes themselves, are often unemployed, don't feel that they're part of can't pluck the fruits of modern life. On the other hand, I think you have a problem with Muslim minorities in the West, in Europe in particular, who don't feel properly integrated and are alienated by the societies in which they are born.
But can you imagine a Muslim, not necessarily a Malay, who says, look, I'm sizing this up for myself and not coming to it hatefully, but in my view, both of our ways may have their problems, but yours does come with this kind of rootlessness. I do see superficiality, triviality, soullessness by my measure. I prefer to stick with my way. Does that make that Muslim an Occidentalist,
No.
A stereotyping, caricaturing, prejudiced person in your view?
No, not as long as such a person doesn't join a politicized religious movement that seeks to destroy what he sees as the enemy. But I don't think it's necessarily it's the right way to or it's a strange way to think, because I think most Muslims in the world wouldn't argue that to have a car or to be able to market your skills freely or speak out freely is somehow incompatible with being a Muslim. I mean, I think the caller was making precisely the point that it is compatible.
Let's get another call. Elaine is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Elaine. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a self-critical American, and I have a lot of negative feelings about our culture and where we're at, and I feel like we are terribly materialistic, and we are falling far short of the magnificent ideals that we were founded on. And it's incredible to me how our policies and actions toward the Muslim world are just so perfectly reinforcing the prejudices they have toward us, and the intense feeling of humiliation they have in regard to the West, which I feel is a really key issue underlying a lot of what's going on. And it's just quite extraordinary to me how what we're doing just seems to be just absolutely just fulfilling all their worst fears and beliefs about us.
And
the rest of the world as a whole.
It looks like gasoline on the fire to you. Let us pick that up. Thanks, Elaine, for your call. Ian Baruma, do you agree?
Well, of course, there are many. It's certainly true that America is in many ways a Western capitalism, or capitalism in general, is in many ways materialistic. There's no question about that. What the religious extremists are saying, of course, goes much further than that. They think the world outside their vision of pure Islam is barbaric and savage, and therefore has to be destroyed. As far as the U.S. relations with the Muslim world or the Arab world is concerned, in a way, the U.S. is damned if it does and damned if it doesn't. The worst resentments are often because the U.S. supports authoritarian regimes in the region, for reasons of national interest and so on. On the other hand, in Iraq, where the ostensible goal is to build free institutions and where the U.S. has toppled a dictator, the U.S. is condemned for that. So it can't do right in a way, and this perhaps should make us think a bit more, with a bit more humility, about the possibilities of what the West can do, in the U.S. specifically.
Let's get one more call. Paul is calling from Boston. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Good evening. Hi.
Hi.
I guess I originally called in. I wanted to follow up the caller before the break talking about the sort of attack of the religion of democracy. And I find that the difficulty is that, you know, the United States might be insensitive or oblivious as to how to bring about consensus when we don't have, you know, our government is not founded on the intertwining of religion, but rather separation of church and state.
Yes, it is.
You know, I think what we find in the Middle East, you know, the cultural weaving of culture, society, and religion, you know, what you see in Israel, what you see in many of the Muslim nations, makes it very difficult for a, quote, you know, pure democracy like the United States to have.
So how should that insight affect American policy, Paul?
Well, I think it's very difficult to generalize about this. I think on local levels, you know, you talk about how we're, you know, the gentleman showed, you know, earlier mentioned that we didn't go in and carpet bomb. We're compassionate. Mm-hmm. We're not using force. But mm-hmm. I think we're more compassionate with the billions of dollars we spend supporting so many nations that, frankly, gets lost in the shuffle of, you know, I hate to say it coming from Boston, but we are the New York Yankees on the global front. We have a lot of resources, and we're not afraid to use them. And unfortunately, it effectively comes across as bullying.
So hold up the good in it, you're saying, Paul, and we've got it. Thanks for that call. Ian Brumley, we've just got a minute or two more here. What's the action plan that comes out of your insight? The New York Times Review looked into your book and said, well, what this is essentially an invitation to the exercise of Western power. You're describing a kind of malignancy here that needs to be forcefully confronted. Is that right?
Well, the New York Times reviewer, of course, is a neoconservative. He's an editor at Commentary, so he would say that. We are not.
In fact, you wrote recently that the neoconservative mission is achieving the opposite of what it intended.
Yes, I do believe that. I don't think going to war with a state, and particularly with a secular state, however horrible it was, and Saddam Hussein was particularly horrible, but going to war is the right way to go about this. I think that the much more effort to integrate Muslim minorities in Western societies is needed, and perhaps a greater distance from authoritarian regimes in the Muslim and Arab world that we've supported so far, because in the illusion that it gives us a great deal of clout. So perhaps less arms sales to countries like Egypt and so on might be one step forward.
But you say you can't get out of Iraq, though you quote moderate Muslims saying they're pinned against the wall by America's presence there.
They are. I think it's made things harder for moderate Muslims because the U.S. is seen as imposing its values as a bully, even if that may not be the intention.
Ian Brumley, thanks so much for the new book, and thank you for being with us this evening.
Thank you.
Ian Brumley, professor of democracy, human rights, and journalism at Bard College, co-author of Occidentalism, The West in the Eyes of Its Enemies. You can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a satirical view of East and West from the world of fiction. This is On Point. Edward Said wrote about Orientalism, Ian Brumley about Occidentalism, but sometimes the sharpest, most critical writing about East and West comes from the world of fiction. In 1956, the British author Rose Macaulay published The Towers of Trebizond. The novel was a sensation in its time, set in modern-day Turkey, then referred to by some as the Levant. Macaulay's book is a deeply satirical story that lampoons English narrowness and the blinkers and bigotry that Western travelers of the time took with them on their voyages to the East. The New York Review of Books recently reissued Rose Macaulay's classic novel. Here's an excerpt from The Towers of Trebizond.
Now comes the news that every radio listener has been hoping to hear.
most important and difficult job before starting on our journey was to pack the camel. Being a racing camel, it could not carry 700 or 800 pounds, as a Bactrian could, but it could manage about 500 to 600. Aunt Dot weighed about 126 pounds, and Father Chantry Pig, 154, which came to 280 between them. And this left, if they both rode the camel at once, nearly 300 pounds for luggage and sometimes an extra rider. Thus loaded, it would cheerfully, except for camels never being really cheerful, do some 25 miles a day at quite a good speed, and would only want to drink every 3 or 4 days. Not that we should be going so far and so fast each day. We should go at a leisurely rate, stopping to talk to people and have drinks in the villages. The day before we started, Xenophon Paraclides, the Greek student who had been staying at Rise with his grandfather, turned up at the hotel in a jeep and asked if he could come with us. It seemed that the jeep was one of his grandfather's and that he had been allowed to borrow it, and it would, as he said, be just the thing for the mountain country. So he said, would he be just the thing, talking Turkish to people and rounding them in to our meetings? And here he was with the jeep, which solved all our transport difficulties and was the very thing for Armenian mountains. And actually, Dr. Halide and I and Father Chantry Pig much preferred it to the camel, so we agreed we would take turns riding the camel behind Aunt Dot, but that in the villages where people would see us, it would be Father Chantry Pig on the camel, as white Arabian camels give dignity and are a sign of prosperity and look very religious and fine, whereas jeeps have a scrubby, irreligious look. Father Chantry Pig remarked that Job in his better days had 6,000 camels, and Aunt Dot said she was glad for every reason not to have been Job. We said goodbye to those we knew in Trebizond, who hoped we should come back, for we had amused them, except the schoolmaster, who did not care for what the mayor had told him about our wanting to start an English school in the town, and except the consul, who had the occupational disease of consuls, which is fear of what their nationals will do next to annoy them. We left the town behind us and followed the road that wound between the mountain Boztepe and the sea by Eleusa Point, and the eastern bay, which was broad and slate blue and full of ships and tumbled with small shaggy waves. And we crossed the Pyxitis and Xenophon's camp, and Xenophon the student said his father had named him that to vex his mother, who wanted to call him Mehmet. From the Pyxitis, I looked back at Trebizond and at the Trapezus rock jutting up between the two great ravines, shaggy with woods and crowned with the broken citadel walls that sprawled round the Byzantine palace, and the small Turkish houses and gardens that crowded inside them. And below was the sea and the harbour where the Greek and the Roman ships had sailed in and out and rocked at anchor in the bay, and all the trade from Asia Minor and Persia had flowed in by ship and caravan, bringing to Trebizond the wealth and the pride and the power that made her the queen of the Euxine. And now the wealth and the pride and the power had ebbed away, and Trebizond was like the descendant of some great line who has become of small account and has a drab name without glory or romance, but is still picturesque, though the new harbour works that had been planned were a desolate litter on the unclean beach, making it a wasteland. Yet I liked the city and its people, and I knew that I should come back to find the glory and the legend, to find Trebizond.
An excerpt from The Towers of Trebizond by Rose McCauley, read tonight by WBUR's Margaret Evans. Originally published in 1956, The Towers of Trebizond has been reissued by the New York Review of Books. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.